Speaker Pagan. My name is Pagan, and I'm an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and fellowship of people like you and sponsorship, I have been sober since February the 4th, 1964, and I'm very grateful for that. I want to thank you for having me. Congratulations to all the birthdays. When I always think, when I see people celebrating birthdays, how there is such a, from 5 years and down, there is a tremendous amount of people, and then from 5 years up, there's a drop-off. And I think one of the reasons that there is because we lose a lot of people between 5 years and 10 years. And my challenge has always been, it not so much of getting here, because really, truly, I mean that. I got here through the grace of God, and the greatest gift I've ever been given. But to stay here, to stay in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and to stay sober is probably the biggest challenge that all of us have. And because, you know, there's a lot of mood changing people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if you've noticed it or not, but there certainly are in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in Nebraska. Let me tell you, it's starting to get winter, and you know, we get a little owly in the winter because there's snow everywhere. So my challenge has been to stay here. I'm a real alcoholic. I just didn't sip a cup of bourbon and come to AA. I mean, I gave it everything I had. I mean, I love to drink. I loved everything about it. I mean, it made my hair curly. It made me tall and skinny. It made me graceful like a ballerina, and it made me beautiful, and it made my boobs grow. I was never blessed by the chest fairy, but by God, when I drank, they went just like that, and I just pooped out. And I got a little twitch in my get along, you know, that I can't even do now. I mean, that I'm 67, and but. It did. It made me, I mean, I was everybody's friend when I drank. You know, it just was they say it was a social lubricant. Boy, it lubricated me, let me tell you. But you know what? I know that there's a ton of people in here that are just like this. You know, we're the most accepting of people. We should be, because we're all, you know, we're all a bubble off a plum. There isn't anybody here who is like, what is normal? I mean, what is normal? And besides, who wants to be it? Who wants to be normal? Who's ever wanted to be normal? I never wanted to be normal. I wanted to have fun. You know, I wanted to push it to the max, you know. And Penny reminded me of this, but I like to think of it as an analogy of a dog and a cat in one body. Because we're like that. All of us are like, I'm like that, you're like that. I know you are, because I sponsor a lot of people. I've been sponsored for years, and I know that. A dog, especially dogs like Labs, and they go, you know, they're like, oh, love me, love me, love me. Am I a good boy? Am I a good boy? I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy. You know, love me, love me, love me. Oh, I did something good. I did something good. You know, I just feed me, feed me, feed me. Oh, yeah, yeah. Thank you, thank you. You know, just like that. We're like that. I mean, I've been like that. And then on the other hand, here's the cat who says, I don't give a damn. Get away from my face. But pay attention to me. And we're like, it's like a dog and a cat fight. And that's the way I, you know, on the one hand, I was this. On the other hand, I was that. And I was all mixed up. I was a human dichotomy. On the one hand, I loved to, I used to, when I was drinking, I would take off my clothes because I felt free. You know, I just, you know, I would be in my room all by myself and I'd be leaping around, you know. And my mother would say, I heard a bunch of noise upstairs last night. What were you doing? I said, I was dancing, you know, and I'd throw myself around in front of this mirror naked. Because I really felt, you know, clothes I felt were proletarian confinements to me when I was, I mean, I need, my genius needed to burst out, you know, or whatever. Because sure as heck my boobs weren't bursting out, you know, so it had to be my genius. And I and on the one hand, I'm an artist and I love great, huge, beautiful florals. And yet I like Andy Warhol, which is very confined and very literal. And I love classical music. And yet if I'm going to dance, I want to dance to something like American Woman. Remember American Woman. I mean, I'm just a dichotomy. I can't make up my mind because my mind can't make up itself. You know, it's just dog and cat fight. That's stressful. It gets stressful to be like that. And so, on the one hand, I would think, I'm so bright that I'm presidential material, which doesn't take much, really, when you think about it. No, I'm not making any commentary politically. I mean all of them, you know. On the other hand, I feel lower than whale poop on the ocean floor. I mean, it's just, and that's stressful. It's very stressful. So, and that's the way, aren't you all like that? I mean, why are you laughing if you are not like that? That's exactly the way you are like that. And I was a kid, and I had a doll. Only doll I ever had, I named her. Her name was Muggsy. Now, to me, that sounds like Italian mafia or something, you know. This is a doll, and it had real skin, you know, that soft skin. And it had the first real hair that, like, grew out of the scalp. Now, I mean, that's a long time ago, because I'm not old. I'm just slightly decrepit, you know. This hair just grew out of these pinpricks in this doll's. And it had not realized it rolled back, but painted on eyes. Well, my father was a doctor, and I operated on this doll. That's what I did. This doll was smitten with a lot of illnesses, and so I would operate. And my mother would help me stitch her up, and she would have tonsillectomies and cut her throat, you know, she would have appendectomies and cut her hair. She'd have hysterectomies, and the best part was when I did a hemorrhoidectomy, you know, across it. And I I do this over and over and over again, and she got real ugly. I mean, she was ugly. She had black stitches all over her and everything. And so one day it was during polio time, and I was being made to take a nap because we had to take naps, you know, to ward off polio. And so my mother told me anyway, but we had to take these naps. Was mad because I had to take this nap, so I pried the screen off my window and threw the doll out the window into Rock Creek Park in Washington, D.C. And it was several weeks later, and then I was struck with panic, you know, because I threw my doll away. So it was two or three weeks later, and my mother said, "Where's Muggsy? I haven't seen Muggsy lately." And I had my story, and this is family lore. I said, Mother, she became depressed over her ill health. And she committed suicide. Now, I'm all of 5 years old, and I'm weird already. I'm already weird. And I got so I like beating people up. Not girls, but boys. I like taking on the challenge of beating up boys. I liked it. That was just, it gave me a sense of power, you know, because I really, the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, our owner's manual, is really truly talking about each and every one of us, and it'll tell us exactly how we are. And it says in there, lack of power, that's our dilemma. Lack of power. And that's, I felt that from the time I was a kid, little kid, dog and cat. And So I like smacking people because they minded me. You know, I just wanted people to be reasonable and mind me. That's all. I just wanted them to mind. If they would mind and do what I said, everything would be just fine. Life would be great. And there was a guy named Flash in our class. Well, he was a big guy. He looked like an avocado. A very large avocado. He had big, you know, big butt, you know, and little tiny shoulders up here. This one of those little heads that you just want to go, just knock off. And he weighed like 630 pounds in the sixth grade. And I was taking up money for the Berlin candy lift. And when we airlifted candy bars over to Berlin for the children of the poor, starving, no candy children in Berlin. And he wouldn't bring his money in. We were supposed to bring in a buck, and I was in charge of this, and he wouldn't bring it in. I said, if you don't bring your money in, he was a nerd. He was a real nerd. He had on, you know, high water jeans and white socks and tennis shoes with lightning bolts on the side. That's why we called him Flash. And he said, well, I'm not bringing in my money. And I said, well, you better bring your money in, and I'm going to beat you up. Well, I weighed 56 pounds. And so he came in, of course, didn't bring his money in. So I said, you meet me after school. And he goes, you know. So it was outside Randolph Elementary School in Randolph Air Force Base, San Antonio. And there's a bunch of hedges along the sidewalk. And I hid in the hedges and waited for him to pass by. And once he got by me, I jumped out of the hedges on top of his back. And I just launched myself at him, you know, because he's... And I go like that, hit him right in the nose. And, of course, it hit him just in that place that hurts really bad. And he just fell to the ground. His nose was bleeding. And I just rode him all the way down, you know, because... It was so hard. I mean, I was locked onto him by then. And all the kids are like, fight, fight, fight. Peggy's beating up Flash. Come on, you know. And, oh. And this is what I am like when I am left untended. Even today, it would be that way. And, so this is what you got, and that causes tension in your life because I got grounded forever until I couldn't even claim to be a virgin anymore. I was grounded. It was a long time, it seemed to me, and I, you know, we lived on an Air Force base, and I listened to planes take off and land. After I got sober, I made my first amends list, and of course, Flash was on it, and my sponsor said, you got to make amends to this guy. You humiliated him in front of his peers. He didn't have any peers, you know. I mean, I didn't like the guy even now. And I said, and I don't feel sorry that, you know, I don't, she said, you don't have to feel anything. You just have to do it if you ever find him. Well, I didn't know his name, never found him. But whenever I go to Texas, I always tell that story because you never know. I mean, he might still be in Texas. And I could say to him, I was wrong to have humiliated you in front of your peers. And then under my breath, I could say, but I'm not sorry, you know, because I'm not. But that's the kind of, I'm not. But that's the kind of kid he was. That's the kind of kid I was, you know, that in those days. That was my reaction. So I had what you might call abnormal reactions to life. And when I got to be about 30, well, I'd been drinking for a little while. No kidding. Up to that point. But when I was about 13, I really started to drink. And I loved everything about it. Gave my boobs grew, my waist nipped in. I could end up in the back seat of cars with guys that I wanted to throw up on the next day, you know. And I had adventures. I mean, when I first drank, and you can't say this, I'm honest to God, this is the truth. When I first drank, I had a great time. Didn't you have a great time? I mean, when I first started drinking, it was not all downhill from immediately. I mean, it gave me something. Man, well, besides boobs, it gave me something. It gave me a lift. You know, it was like, oh, I can do anything. Oh, this is the best thing since sliced bread. It's better than sliced bread. You know, this is great. And I had no consequences at first. And then I got to the place in my drinking, you know, when I was 16, 17 years old in there, where I was having consequences. I mean, there were things happening, but it was still a lot of fun. You know, one time this friend of mine, Peanut, and I were out at Lake Worth, and we took off our clothes, and we went skinny dipping, and we were drunk. And it was late, 11, 12 o'clock at night, and it was late. We were supposed to be home at midnight. We were out at Lake Worth, long way away. And we went swimming, and we came out of the lake, and our clothes were gone. Our shoes were there. Our little shoes were lined up right there. They had our shoes. But our friends had stolen our clothes, and they'd thrown them in bushes somewhere. But here, we thought it was funny, of course, because we're laughing. They stole our clothes. And we're walking totally naked up a gravel road, and here come the cops, you know, and they're shining lights on us, and here we are, you know. And they bundled us in the car, and they found our clothes, and we got clothes, and we went back to the house, and and here were Peanut's parents. We were supposed to spend the night there, lined up like birds on a wire. They were a rather dour family anyway, and they were sitting there like this, and no one said a word. And Aunt Till said to me, "Your father is coming." Oh, that was bad news to me, because my father was by then a colonel in the Air Force, and you just don't do that, you know. You just don't do that. He didn't speak to me for about 2 or 3 days. He never said a word to me. And he just, you know, I respect, this is my hero. This is the man I took care of for the last 3 years. You know, this is honest to God. I cannot tell you how grateful I am to have had him as my father. I can't tell you what a privilege it was for me to be able to take care of him for the last years of his life. I've heard people say that before, but I honestly mean it. It was the very least I could do, because he took care of me. You know, something that I really mean very seriously, because all joking aside, is that of course I'm the one that took care of him. Of course it was me. It was only right that it was me, because I'm the one that owed the most to my parents. And I've taken care of my mother, who's a whole different situation. But you know what? He's the guy that taught me all the values that AA brought back to me. When I was drinking, I lost all those values. And I grew up with good values, values of commitment and love and honesty and discipline, and a spiritual life and that kind of thing, and fun, to have fun, and to stick by your family and that sort of thing. And I had good parents, and alcohol, they were the first to go. Alcohol took them away. They moved away because they couldn't take the alcohol. And that's what I give up. You know, alcohol is a great remover. It removes a lot of stuff like self-esteem, like money, like your marriage, like your kids, like your houses, your cars. And for me, because I was still single, it took away my self-respect. It took away my parents. It took away their respect. And so, of course, it was me that was allowed to take care of them. Of course it was. I you know, that was God's plan for me, was to do that, to be able to make those long-term amends to them because I loved them and I loved my father. I loved my father. And when he didn't speak to me for 3 days, it was like a knife in my heart. But I was to put knives in his heart many more times than that. I went to Washington University in St. Louis. I drank overseas. I mean, I've had a fabulous life. I've lived on several continents, and I mean, I've had a fabulous life. I'm educated far beyond my intelligence. I always have been. I went to Europe, went to interpreter school, went to the University of Paris and got a degree from there. You know, I mean, it's just, I've had I went to an English girls' school, and I drank on every continent I was. I mean, it was just like I was drinking and ended up there and went to school kind of thing. Really, that's the way it was. And, I mean, I got into a big riot in Paris because we were drinking, you know, and I didn't know I was with the communists. I mean, I didn't know. I mean, we were drinking. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. I mean, when I was living in California, I used to live down at, I was at the University of California in Redlands, and I came up in this neck of the woods and somehow got hooked up with Cesar Chavez and the lettuce pickers. Don't ask me how, but I mean, this was a huge movement up here, and I just was drinking with them. I mean, that's what I was. And they, you know, I'd be in this bar and have one bunch of politics in this bar. It was just whoever was buying, I was buying their politics, you know, and that's the way it was in France. I didn't know they were communists until I marched on the American embassy. I mean, I had no idea. I'm marching along, having a good time, swinging my wine bottle, you know, and they're chanting and stuff, and we end up, and I go, oh, that's my flag. Oh, dear. You know, and I'm right up against the thing of the American embassy. So, you know, I'm starting to have a few consequences here. I come out of a blackout in the middle of the night in Geneva, Switzerland. And I, the last I remember was a Scotsman boyfriend of mine walking ahead of me down the sidewalk. We'd been drinking wine all afternoon. I'm flipping up the back of his kilt. And I'm thinking they don't have underwear on. And I was wondering, you know, and like all of my sexual experiences of those days, I don't remember. I don't have a clue whether he had underwear on or not. And then I come out of a blackout and I'm with an Italian. And he's telling me I need to go to Mass in the morning. So I'm in Mass with him the next morning in a brownout, if you know what a brownout is. I'm in this, like, brownout, sitting there with incense and priests and swinging stuff and people up and down and up and down. And I'm not Catholic. I mean, I'm not Catholic. I don't know what I'm doing there. I'm supposed to confess something that I don't remember. You know, just... I'm getting spiritual consequences, you know. It's like, am I damned? You know, because he seemed to be very concerned about the state of my soul. And so, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I was in. I come back to the United States and I'm out here and I'm drinking in Southern California and I'm my best friend's a guy that looked like Father Sarducci, you know, on Saturday Night Live with the black cape and hat. And we called him Zorro. And Zorro would smoke dope, and I would drink vodka from my thermos under the eucalyptus trees at the University of Redlands, actually the University of California at Riverside. And I mean, I was getting what I call dumb drunk. You know, you just every day, it's just dog drinking. You're just sucking on a bottle, dog drinking. And it was got, you know, I'll tell you what, to fast forward somewhat. I was given the greatest gift in February, very beginning of February of 1964, that I think anybody can ever, ever, ever be given, and that is the gift of desperation. And I believe that that gift is good when I got sober, and I think it's good sometimes today. Because sometimes my behavior, I need to have desperation in order to change. And I'll tell you people talk a lot about having these big and effective surrenders. And certainly my surrender was effective. But I don't think I surrendered. I think what happened to me was that I was surrendered. Now, it sounds like semantics, but really it's not. To have been surrendered is something completely outside of me. It's like John Barleycorn just beat me to a pulp. And then I go, like this. Because the way that I surrender stuff is like, okay, all right, I'll do it your way. Now, but it wasn't like that at all. This was like, and I don't know if any of you know that, I mean, stick with me on this, but it's like, I'm so tired. I just can't do it anymore. I'm tired. I can't do it. I can't move. I can't make a decision. I can't. I'm just tired. I'm done. If somebody had said, in order for you to get sober, somebody's got to run over you with a car, I think I would have just gone, okay. Rev her up. I was done. I mean, I couldn't move. I just couldn't move. I didn't have a single better idea. I didn't know what to do. And my mother, I started to cry. I hadn't cried in years. And my mother heard me crying. And my mother has Alzheimer's now. And she claims absolutely that she got me sober. But in a way, she did. And she came up the stairs. She goes, she's crying. Let's get her and throw her in the car. So they threw me in the back seat of this Porsche automobile, folded me in half, actually, in the back end of this Porsche, drove me out the country and unfolded me on the porch of a place outside of Washington, D.C., and dried me out in this place in Washington, D.C., with the wife of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and a Pulitzer Prize winner and a few other people and me, the little drunken idiot. Here, unfolded on the porch. And of the people that were in that it wasn't really a treatment center so much as it was a drying out place. And we were there for 30 days, and they gave us some rudimentary information about alcoholism. But the most important thing was that I was off the streets for 30 days. And I saw, and they took us to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when we were the people who came in the little buses, way long ago, it would be 42 years this February, way long ago, they brought us in little buses or station wagons or however we got there to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wanted to say this too. We're a wonderful, accepting, and loving people. That is the dog in us. We are, and cats are loving too. I love Penny's boys, but we're like we're loving people. It's just that we're so scared to feel that. We're scared to feel it. We're scared to risk loving. And we come here to Alcoholics Anonymous and we're driven here by the fact, really, that we're really afraid that nobody is ever going to love us again, and that we are not capable of loving anyone else. And we walk in here, and here are rooms full of people just like us. This is a safe, well-lighted place. This is safe here. We don't shoot our wounded. Well, if we did, we'd all be dead. Because we are all wounded in some way. Now, when I got sober, and this is true today, I think we have this little kind of joyous person inside who is just scared to death to jump out. I think we have a lot. I think that that little guy inside of us, that, you know the feeling, it comes and goes very rapidly, but it's like, oh, like that. You know that feeling? Like, oh, you know, it's just wonderful. It's like when the bourbon first hits your stomach, you know, it's like, oh, only we're feeling this sober. And sometimes we sit in meetings and we go, I'm grateful to be sober, to keep the plug in the jug. And we're not, in my view, expressing what is the joy in us or the God in us. Because I think laughter and enthusiasm and greeting people and doing all the things that are done here is God's song. It's like I can hear him singing when you do that and when I am participating in that. And it's like, you know, when people, one of the things, one of my first jobs was to be greeter. And I thought, I don't want to be greeter. No, my sponsor said, you be greeter. Oh, she walked up to me, by the way, and said, I'm your sponsor. And I didn't know you could say no. So I just go, okay. And I followed her around. I hung on her shoulder, hung her on her coattails. You know, I'd hang on to her dress, kind of, and just trot along behind her. Because I was scared, you know. And she said, go home and practice smiling. Because I hadn't smiled in so long, you know. And so she said, practice smiling. Go home. And I went home in front of that mirror I used to jump around naked in front of. And I go, welcome to the friendship group. You know, this, like this. And I realized that I hadn't smiled in so long. And so by the time I was greeter for a while, I became so good at it that I was greeting people 30 years sober and saying, look, we have a piece of literature here. Have this. And just giving away literature to people who had stacks of it at home. You know, I didn't care. I was expressing that joy in me. And that's what we do when we clap. Yay! People come up and read, you know. And so, well, we're notorious, terrible readers, you know, because we're so ADD and all that stuff. I can't read. You know, and we can't pronounce anonymity. I think it's a dirty joke, you know. It's just horrible. You know, and one time I read something and it said, sought through prayer, and I said, sought through prayer and medication. I thought, no, that's not right. I mean, we're terrible. Terrible readers, and yet we all go, yay! You know, the worse you are, the better we like it. You know, we're encouraging you. This is an encouraging sort of crowd. You know, we jump, and that is expressing the joy in us. And like this old guy was sitting at the front of our meeting, he used to greet people, for heaven's sake, and we'd walk in and say, welcome to the meeting. You know, we're glad you're here. And this young girl would say, this is an old joke, but it's true. She said, Pete, are you happy? Oh, I'm very happy. And she said, why don't you tell your face? And it's the same thing here. When a newcomer comes in, do I want someone that's standing at the door to look like I feel? I don't think so. I want to have somebody stand in the door that says, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to be so glad you're here. And of course they'll go, oh, sure, you know, inside there. But that's the way I feel. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Why shouldn't I express it? It saved my life. And it's continuing to save my life. I just finished up a 6-week commitment to be greeter at my home group. And I think I make a very good greeter. I'm old, but I'm a good greeter, you know, because I believe in that. The first time I ever shook somebody's hand and felt somebody else was when somebody shook mine. When I walked in the door. Because I was scared. We're all scared. We need to be in a place like this where we can be, feel safe and tell everybody, I'm scared today, you know. I mean, we certainly can't go to work and your boss say, how you doing today? And you say, oh, just your basic, ordinary, terrified. You know, I mean, they don't want to hear that. I mean, they're paying you big bucks, you know, to just be there. Or, you know, say, like Penny was saying the other day, she looked out her window. She was working on her computer. She looked out her window and she saw her car, Nuke had a new car in her driveway, and she thought, I guess people drive past this place thinking a grown-up lives here. And, I know the feeling. I know the feeling. When am I ever going to grow up? You know, well, maybe never. Maybe never. And maybe I'm never going to be, I don't know, maybe I'm never going to be like the dignified, astute, intelligent, philosophical, spiritual giant that my mother always wanted me to be. But I am me, and I'm not afraid. And I love God, and more importantly, I know God loves me. And I never knew that. Not all those years did I know that, and I know that now. And I got sober, and they just put me to work right away. I was secretary. I had to work with Crazy Frank washing cups. And I don't want to work with Crazy Frank. He's crazy. And she said, think of something to ask him. Make polite conversation with him. I don't want to talk to him. He's really scary. He was 6'7", and he kind of, you remember Lurch? You know how they. He was like Lurch, you know, and he kind of loomed over people, and he certainly loomed over me. And I looked up at him while we were back there washing cups one night, and I said, so Frank, must be nice for you being so tall. And he said, why? And I said, well, you're a painter, aren't you? You probably don't have to use a ladder to paint the ceilings. And he went like that. And all of a sudden, I realized, Frank's not, he's misunderstood. He's not crazy like everybody thinks. He's just like me. And we made the best cup washing team. It was great. And, I mean, I learned, she was socializing me. I was doing all kinds of stuff like that. And I met and married my husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. I broke all the rules. I wouldn't recommend doing it the way I did. I don't know. I mean, he was new, you know. This is. And I met him in June, and we got married in August. I sponsored some people now, and I'd kill them if they did something like that. But we've been married for 39 years will be 40 years next August. So I think it works, you know. So, and we live the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous in our marriage, and it works very well. And then some days we forget, and it's hell. Sorry, take it off the tape, whoever's doing it. Oh, I can do that, can I? But you know, I've noticed a few things since I've been sober, and I want to just touch on those. That we don't ever outgrow our character defects. I know I was out here. I don't know if Penny was there or not, but I was out here in San Jose a number of years ago, and I was speaking on Saturday night, and I got really scared because there's a lot of people there, like 5,000 people or something, and there was like 10,000 eyeballs, and I'm really scared. I'm thinking, oh, my God. I mean, I thought for the first time in my entire life I would go completely blank and I'd get up there and just not be able to say anything. My ego was getting the best of me, you know, my easing God out thing that I carry with me all the time, like a sack. And I'm sitting outside watching Susie the Souse or Sadie the Souse or something. They're singing and dancing. It was real fun. I had on my yellow silk speaking dress. And I'm humming, you know. I'm like, oh, what are you going to say? You can't just, I'm a little broad from Nebraska. You can't, you know, what are you going to say? My God, go Big Red. What are you going to do? I mean, I don't know. So I felt, and I'm really in myself, and I felt something wet hit my hand. And I looked up because I thought it was raining. And I looked down and it was white. And a friend that was sitting next to me go, ooh, a bird crapped on your back. So, you know what? My dad used to say all the time, for some people, they sing. For others, they crap, you know? So, for me, this bird, crap. So I laughed because what it did was it said to me, honey, you know, you're just a kid from Nebraska. Go up there and tell your story and show them your poop, you know? I mean, what are they? They're going to love. And, you know, it's like God came to me and said, you know, for some people, they sing, and for you, they just happen to crap. So just live with it, you know? And I just lived with it, and I went, and I told my story, and all they wanted to see was the bird poop anyway. I mean, I brushed it off, but I left the little thing on there, you know, where it was. And I think it was a seagull because it was fish. It had fish in it. It was really pretty bad. But I was in a hurry, too. And, you know, so, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I could do. That God just revealed these things to me. But I've only got 5 minutes, so I want to tell you this. I really want to tell you this because this has been so important to me. Because we could go on. I mean, I've been sober almost 42 years. That's a lot of stories. And we're the best storytellers in the world, don't you think? Isn't that what we have? That you know, there's such a store set by storytellers today in our society. We've been storytellers for years. For 70 years, we've been storytellers. We've been relating to one another in our stories all through these years, sometimes over kitchen tables, sometimes on road trips and cars, sometimes at our sponsor's house, and sometimes at meetings, and sometimes through the podium. But we're storytellers, so I have a million of them. But my father, as I told you, my father died this year in March, and he was 95 years old. And everything that he taught us and my mother taught us when we were growing up was so important to what I did when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, because he taught me commitment and discipline and perseverance and a spiritual way of life and those sorts of things. And I abandoned all those. And when I got sober, those were the principles and the things that came back to me. And I will tell you this, if you have not sat or cared for someone who is dying, they do move. In their eyes, there is a telling movement. They move slowly to a spiritual life, to a spiritual place. I never believed in heaven. I always thought it was probably like a meeting, a good meeting. But when my dad started dying in front of me, I saw him move. And let me tell you this in closing. There is no way without Alcoholics Anonymous that this could have happened. Because on my 40th AA birthday, my father, unbeknownst to me, unbeknownst to everyone, at the close of the meeting said, I want to say something. Now, I was a little intimidated about what he was going to say, but he had a difficult time getting to the podium because he was in a tremendous amount of pain from his hip. But he got to his feet and he went to the podium and he had his little blue blazer on. This was a man who had been in the service of his country for years and who had been a world champion skeet shooter who, you know, he had lived an amazingly effective life. He was a bright man, a doctor. And he got to the podium and he said, I have been in the company of princes and kings and government heads and very influential people in our lives and in our times. But I have never been in the company of any kinder people than in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you brought my daughter back to me. And you have loved us in our old age, and you have included us in the gatherings that you have when most of our friends have died. And I love that in you, something to that effect. And, of course, there was not a dry eye in the house because he meant every word. And so I used to feed a fox, and it reminds me of this so much. I used to feed a fox, and this fox, this family of foxes, and it was very cold in Nebraska, like 30 below, and I had on my coat, and I was walking the dogs, and I would always do the same thing. I'd dump out the food on the ground, and I would say, "Here's your breakfast, foxies," and I would turn to leave. And this one day, I felt something. And I looked over my shoulder, and as close to me as this guy is, sat the fox. And he was, now they say wild animals don't ever look at you, but this, he was looking me right in the eye. And what I read in the few seconds that we had was he, first of all, slowly laid down in front of me. And what I knew and could feel in that gesture was, thank you. Thank you for feeding me. Thank you for helping me get through the winter. Thank you for making it possible for me to love my father and to care for him and to be there when he died. And thank you for my kids and my friends and the respect of my peers. Thank you for the ability to be sober, to be alive, and to be here. And I want to tell you something. I just have been going to meetings. I'm just a kid from Nebraska. And it's the most important thing in my life. And I hope that when you leave here, you will remember that it's important to you. Thank you.